will be introducing our next featured leaders for Conscious Partnering Conference, and just really a delight and honor to introduce them, I have to say. I'll go ahead and introduce Gangaji first, because we got to know each other last year. It's one of the first Shift Network courses we offered, and it was a true spiritual satsang, the journey that we went on. And Gangaji is known to many as a spiritual teacher. She's grew up in Mississippi and went through a whole series of different life paths before she went to India, found her true spiritual teacher, Punjaji or Papaji, he was known as, and really made a shift into a very profound awakened state, and has been able to share that worldwide and travel and speak to seekers of every walk of life, and through her own books and work in prison system, really has served as an embodiment of what does it look like to live a really awakened, heartfelt, loving life. So Gangaji, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Stephen and Deva. I'm really happy to be a part of this.
Great. And Deva, if you could introduce Eli for us.
Yes, it's my pleasure to introduce Eli Jackson Bear. And there's many different things I could say about him. He is also a student of Punjaji, and his path started quite a long time ago. 18 years of his spiritual path had started in 1971 when he was a federal fugitive during the Vietnam War. And his path, I know, took many twists and turns until he finally met his final teacher, Punja, and went through a deep spiritual awakening process. And then confirming Eli's realization, his teacher sent him back into the world to share his unique psychological insights into the nature of egoic suffering in support of self-realization. He's also written a number of different books, including Sudden Awakening into Direct Realization, The Enneagram of Liberation, and he is also the editor of Wake Up and Roar. So many things under both of their belts, and quite a delight to have you here as a couple together as part of our summit. Welcome to you, Eli.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here with you both.
And we're a transatlantic couple today, since Eli is, we have Eli calling in from Europe. So this is a great pleasure and honor. And I'd love for you just to maybe share a bit of context about what brought you together as a couple, and then how that evolved into this real spiritual teaching partnership that you have.
Oh, I would love to start with that, because Eli was reluctant to be a couple when we first got together, and I was determined that I had finally met the man, not of my dreams, because he didn't fit any idealization I'd had, but it was just undeniable that this is the man I should be with and had to be with in a couple. And I was with a man who, first of all, wasn't interested in being in a committed couple and was interested in the spiritual path. And while I had played with that in the 70s in San Francisco and Northern California, it was part of the lifestyle. I hadn't committed myself to it, but I can say with great gratitude that I realized in order to be with this man, and that was my motive, I had to turn my sights toward a bigger life, a spiritual life. And I did that, and the rewards have just been everlasting.
Eli?
So beautiful. Yes, as Gangaji said, I was not interested in relationship. I wasn't interested in partnership. I didn't want a family. I didn't want to settle down. When I met Gangaji, I'd been single, happily single on the road on my spiritual path. I was 29 years old. I'd never been in a serious relationship that lasted more than maybe 6 months, and I wasn't looking for it. I didn't want to have children, and therefore I saw no point to it. To me, it was just a drag. It was something that would bring me down, bring me focused into the small world, and I'd already given my life to something bigger. And the great miracle of Gangaji's true love and her steadfastness and her clarity is that she became the greatest gift that I ever could have received, that she is the living embodiment of a goddess. She is the Satguru. And after 13 years together, of living together, I fell at her feet and kissed her feet and said, "You are the living Satguru." She didn't know what that meant even, but that was her purity and her clarity. She didn't have the name, but she was the embodiment of impeccability. And I bow to that, and I'm so grateful. She's the greatest gift that I could have imagined.
Well, Eli, it's so beautiful to hear you speak in this way about Gangaji. It's often, you know, a person's partner who sees the behind the scenes and the aspects of oneself that perhaps are not so enlightened and beautiful, and to have you, who's with her behind the scenes, falling at her feet, as you say, I think that's that really says it, a volume about you, Gangaji, and to have him be, I don't think Stephen
would probably
be.
And about Eli as well.
And about him as well, for the humility and the willingness. Yeah, yeah. So it's really beautiful. And one thing I just wanted to pick up on from both of you is, I think for many people who are on a spiritual path, there's this sense that, you know, your spiritual path is really primary and everything else falls away. It's really about, you know, your own awakening, and that, you know, that needs to come before any relationship, family. And so I often see people that are kind of split in that way, and wondering, you know, how the two of you have really reconciled partnership as perhaps a core part of your spiritual path.
Well,
when we got married, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, please, thanks.
I was going to say, when we got married, we were married in a cave in Haleakala, in Maui, in 1989, and we spontaneously exchanged vows, and our vows were that if the relationship supports freedom, then we support the relationship, and if the relationship doesn't support freedom, then the relationship has to go. That the relationship was in service of our awakening, and not the other way around.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm sorry, Eli. We aren't in the same spot as Stephen Mitchell.
There's probably a little time lag over the transatlantic wires, too, so we'll just be patient with
them. I'm in Berlin and Gangaji's in California, so.
Yeah.
Oh, please,
Gangaji.
Sorry, honey.
So I was just going to say, you know, in the early part of our relationship, even though I was on a spiritual path, I mean, it didn't take much for me to realize that this was where the real bounty of a life could be. But my primary concern was with our relationship, and in a way I was kind of in charge of that. And so, like everybody in relationship, we had lots of problems. You know, we were two very different characters. I was brought up in Mississippi. Eli was brought up in New York City. And we're both very strong, opinionated characters. And so we had a lot that had to work out. But there was, and at different times, one or the other would try to leave the relationship. And at those times, the one determined to stay in the relationship really wouldn't let the other one leave. It was, no, we are in this together. There's something we have got to find. And we got together in 76, and as Eli was saying, we didn't get married until 89, and it took that long for us to really be able to have the clarity where we could make those vows and have them be real. I had to actually discover for myself that there was something more important than our particular relationship. And Eli, I will speak for you. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I had to discover that the relationship could be in total service to that, and was in service to that.
Beautiful foundation for partnership. And I'm wondering if you can reflect a little, since both of you have really gone through a very deep realization and awakening, and then continued relationship from a pre-awakening state to post. How did that really shift things when you both went through a spiritual awakening at, I think, at different times? And then how did that shift how you held the relationship and engaged the relationship?
Well, you know, we met Papaji at actually around the same time, within a few months of each other. And so I would say that our relationship radically, you know, we don't hold the relationship, I would say, but it's something that happens. And it happened completely differently after meeting Papaji and everything stopping, so that all our roles were reversed. I mean, for the first part of our relationship, I was the one who had the money, and I supported us, and it all came out of our pocket, but I earned it. And I was the teacher, and Gangaji was my student, and then she was my assistant, and there were all these roles that we had as man and woman that were stopped dead in our tracks. And suddenly, you know, Gangaji was the one who was the star. and I was her student. I became her first devotee and helped set up her satsangs, and Gangaji was the one making money, and all the props that previously were unexamined got kicked out from under us, I would say. Would you say that, honey? Is that accurate?
Yeah. Right. I would say the roles were reversed, and there was quite a bit for each of us to learn in that, because there was still more to come. Of course, we had to finally let go of either one of us being the alpha person in the relationship and recognize it really was a partnership. It really is a partnership, but it had to evolve to that point.
I think this is something that's actually really worth going into more depth around, because I know that power dynamics are something that most couples face, especially as both people have their own aspirations, visions, dreams. And so I'd love to just hear a little bit more about how you navigated those shifting roles, especially since when it shifted, as you're just speaking, you know, where Gangaji was the one that was more the star, more making money. I'm imagining that could be very challenging for a man, perhaps. And so how have you navigated that in the past and continue to navigate that through time?
I was thrilled, actually, when it happened. You know, I mean, I told Papaji, you have to meet my wife. She's the Satguru. And it was quite clear. And when it was, I was the first one to call her Gangaji and sit at her feet. And I'm just so grateful. I'm so grateful that the world has noticed and that her benefit is radiated out and has touched countless lives all over the world. Really, this was our mission together, and it's incredible. It's just incredible. It's a long way from our little space in Bolinas where we're, little hippies together.
Eli did handle it really beautifully. He surrendered. He recognized his sort of natural leadership and the capacity to be arrogant in that leadership, and he recognized that this was perfect for him. It was a perfect test for him. And I would say, really, Deva, he handled it better than I did. In retrospect, and it was a retrospect that we had to go through when our marriage fell apart a few years ago, and we had to really look at our partnership over time and see what we had been doing to sabotage ourselves and to sabotage our spiritual life. And one of the things I had to recognize is that when I became the teacher in our relationship, that I sort of used it in a way to get him back for being the teacher when he was the teacher.
Turnabout is fair play, huh?
Yeah, it was really shocking, because it was subtle, of course, but it was just there, and it was based on some unhealed aspects of our relationship and resentments and things that are naturally different in our makeup, and how that had just congealed in a very subconscious way that had to be made conscious. But anyway, so it was an ongoing thing that was happening, and I liked being the leader, and maybe I liked it a little too much there.
That's very refreshing honesty. Well, you're touching on this aspect of, like, really healing, integrating, or re-owning kind of disowned parts of ourselves, and often that's one of the best gifts of relationship. And I'm wondering if you guys have a particular way that you go about doing that, or if you're noticing something in each other or yourselves, and how you engage that dance of kind of reclaiming all aspects of ourselves together.
Great question. You know, we've had different ways over time, and one of the ways that we used to use that we haven't felt the need to use now, we're so willing at this point just to speak if we feel that something's going on with the other, or if we're feeling something in ourselves, and we're also willing to let little outbursts of energy, anger energy or whatever, just happen and move on from it. But at one time, and this was very useful for me, we would sit in meditation with one another and first of all take turns just actually verbalizing what we disliked most about each other. And the other would just...
Actually, going one at a time, without... You receive it without commenting on it. Excuse me, let me just clarify that for a moment, so that Gangaji would sit and tell me everything that's wrong with me, everything she doesn't like about me. And I just had to sit and accept it and take it. And then we'd switch and we'd play the roles back. And then what do you love about each other? That would happen as well.
A very bold practice.
It was so important because it was permission to say what was fermenting under there, and also permission, and of course the skill of it was to not end with that, but to end with what do we love about each other. And it was incredible. It really worked, and we knew that we could be honest and the other wouldn't react or wouldn't get into a discussion about how that's not so or how it's because of you or something you did. You could, even if it was absurd, we could say it so it could be aired, it could be brought into the light.
It actually reminds me of a practice that Stephen and I did for a while as we were engaged for about a year. We did a practice that we would call withholds, which we would just, you know, purposely go into, you know, what are those things that we haven't been saying to each other? Or we'd also have a time that we'd say, okay, you have permission to rant about each other or whatever else might be going on, and to, you know, to kind of bracket that in sacred space. But it really opens up a lot of permission, but I know there also needs to be quite a lot of trust as a foundation to be able to tolerate, you know, that, which can sometimes be very painful to hear those things coming from someone you love.
Very painful. So the trust is the ground.
Really, it's the commitment to truth. I mean, really, both of us said our relationship is about a commitment to truth. And so then that commitment becomes the ground that can bear the painful unbearableness of hearing it and not defending against it. Because that's my tendency, is to say, no, that's not right. That's because, you know, no, I didn't do that. Or no, that's, and to justify and to put up some wall against simply receiving it. And so that was really the practice. certainly benefited me.
Yeah, it was a very alive time, you know, when we would have these meetings, because the reason we would have them is that stuff had built up to such a point that we weren't communicating, and so we had to, first of all, be willing to tell the truth that we are withholding from each other, and so let's let it out. And I found it very cleansing.
Were there things that you both did to cultivate that ground of trust so that, I'm imagining that was something that probably happened through time, but so that there was the strength of the container to be able to do that kind of practice, which, you know, some could see as a radical practice. Many talk about appreciation of each other, but not often, you know, what you don't like about each other.
Well, you know, I have just always loved this man. It's our third meeting, I believe, and I had idealizations about him as a partner and as a person and as a spiritual teacher, and I think all idealizations have to be burst. And so there were moments when the relationship was really shook to its ground, but the love was so strong that I know for myself I had to always return to the hard work of the relationship. That's what it required. I mean, we were speaking of in our initial getting together, and the fact that he didn't want to be in a partnership, this was excruciating to me. I'm 5 years older than Eli, and so I was ready for a relationship. I'd been through a marriage. I'd been through sort of freewheeling with different partners, and I was ready for a commitment. So it did not fit my pictures. But there was such a love, and that's what I trusted. And really, that's the theme of our talk. Love is trustworthy. And it's not always easy. And it was incredibly difficult, especially at the beginning. But it was trustworthy, and we are here to testify to that.
One question that comes up, you've referenced several times when your marriage almost broke down, and I know that was a very public process and very painful in many ways. And just curious about some of the, so you kind of worked out a challenging dynamic in a more public way, and what are some of the benefits of that kind of transparency? I'm thinking of things like, you know, to kind of taking the guru off the pedestal a little bit so people can see some of their own issues in what the two of you were working through, or what were some of the hidden blessings in that?
I can say there were a lot of blessings, and they were excruciating in part because we are actually had always treasured the privacy of our lives. But when the initial publicity happened, we actually had a town meeting where we invited the whole town so we could address what had happened and speak what our experience was, and really to let everybody know that we never had idealizations about ourselves, and that if they had had idealizations that we were anything other than human, we really prayed that this may be used for the benefit of all. And I do believe it did benefit many, and for many people it just was, you know, a reason to leave and or a reason to act out in ways that that didn't serve anybody. So it was a mixed bag, I would say, Steve.
It was a test of love for everyone. It was really a test of what is it you really love. And if what you love is an ideal or an image or some idea of something that isn't real, it was shattered. And if what you love is what's solid and real and is actually love itself, then it deepened you and took you into a place deeper than it was before. So in that, it was an initiation and a test. And many people did very beautifully with it.
How did you actually work through that you know, initial fall apart, which I know that many people go through? When you look at, you know, the divorce rates, they're pretty darn high for people nowadays. And so I think it's very instructive to see, you know, when something begins to fall apart, what was the pathway towards, you know, putting it back together for you two?
Well, we really had to have a clean cut. It's like we'd been together, as Gangji said, from 1976 until this was 2006. So, actually 2005. So, that's, what, 40 years? 30 years? I don't remember, but we've been together for all this time, and we had to cut it. And that was the most difficult, painful thing, for me anyway. For Gangaji's benefit, I realized I had to cut her free. And that was maybe the most selfless act I've ever had to do in my life, because I didn't want to. I really didn't want to. I loved her, and I wanted to hold on to her, and I realized that I was causing her suffering, and that her life would be better if I cut her loose. And so I did, and she cut me loose. And for her, it was a great liberation.
Oh, it was beautiful, actually. I was finished with the relationship. You know, it was over. I mean, there was pain, but there was a liberation with that, as I was no longer in this relationship. And I got to see that I had always judged older women who were alone and felt sorry for them. And I realized, well, this is a beautiful way to be. I don't have to answer to him, and I don't have to worry about calling him. And I knew that we would be deep friends. I had no doubt about that. I knew the love was undisturbed. But the form of our relationship, as it started to fall apart, we let it fall apart completely. And we were out of communication for a little brief time. And then we really wanted to end it in a conscious way, where we could end it in love as it had begun in love. And we got together in Australia to end our relationship. And as it ended, as we each let each other go, we found ourselves back together in a fresh way. And in finding ourselves back together and finding ourselves drawn back to the love, we had the capacity and the energy to actually deconstruct the 30 years that we had spent together to uncover whatever had been lying, fermenting under there that had poisoned our relationship to some degree. I just want to be clear that we had a great relationship. Eli's often expressed that in the depths of it, it was absolutely perfect, and in the surface of it, it was perfect. But there was a middle ground that was not perfect, and that middle ground finally penetrated into the surface to destroy the relationship, and it had to be destroyed. It was no good at that point. It had played itself out.
And so in coming together to actually separate, you got back together in that process and are now back together as a couple, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what my thought.
We had to let each other go.
Yeah.
We had to be free to not
be. Like, how things, so that sort of, you call almost like the dark night of the soul of a relationship, and then like, so how did things open up in a different way on the other side of that? Like what new aspects or emergent qualities of relationship happened afterwards?
Well, the truth-telling that we had to go through of the deconstructing of our relationship just freed up so much psychic space that we didn't even know was involved. It was, as Gangaji said, it wasn't on the surface and it wasn't in the depths, but in this middle subconscious ground, there was stuff running that had to be exposed and told the truth about. And then that, it disappears. And then there's this, we were back as in a honeymoon. I mean, we got married December 7th, 1995.
Remarried.
And it was a honeymoon for years after that. And so our relationship has never been better.
Well, another question I had is also just around, so you both travel extensively and do teaching work, and like a lot of couples that have, I don't know if you'd call what you have a career per se or calling, but you know, demands from the world on your time and energy and focus. What do you find are the most important elements that keep you guys alive and juicy and connected with each other week to week while you're serving your larger service in the world?
Skype is great.
Skype has been really incredible. I'm in Berlin, Gangaji's in Tahoe, and we can Skype and see each other and love each other and kiss each other, and it's great.
It's just, it's wonderful to have calls and whatever, but to actually see each other and just, even if it's a fuzzy reception, it's wonderful. Skype is really a revolution in people being able to be apart and be together at the same time. That's a plug for Skype, I guess.
So it's just the regularity of the contact. Sounds like it's really essential, even when you're separated, to keep the love.
Well, here's what I would say, Stephen. I wouldn't say that the relationship is ever an issue when we are separate, but just personally, I feel really great when I get to see him. I don't have a fear that if I didn't get to see him, if we couldn't Skype, that the relationship would be in peril in any way. It's wonderful to actually be able to connect. I mean, it's also foreseeable that we could be in places where we couldn't do that, and it would be really, that's not the issue. The issue is just the comfort of seeing each other.
The love of connection. Love of sharing. Love of being in each other's space.
We like each other a lot.
Maybe just to deepen that a little bit is, you know, I find with many of the couples that we're surrounded by who also have a lot of demands on their time, how do you really balance the external work and the teaching and the working with many different students in different parts of the world with your own personal life and private life, and what for you is the right balance between those two to keep them both alive and thriving?
Well, I never consider it.
Well,
I
find it really is a balancing act, and often I've found, I traveled a little too much this time, and so it's kind of falling off and getting back on and rearranging schedule, and we are so lucky that we are free to actually arrange our schedules as we like. And sometimes Eli will come someplace where I'm just teaching. Quite often when we're together, we're teaching together. And sometimes I will go to where he is teaching, and I'm just with him. That's the way it's set up in the next few months. And that's really sweet, so that we get to be together and have our work, that there's no separation. And in fact, we're in Ashland less time this 2011 than we've ever been, but we are together most of that time. Is that clear? Did that make sense?
Yeah, I'm curious. There's one question that we're curious about with a lot of folks this week is just this: the balance between the individuality and the union or the merging, the we, the I and the we. And given your perspective from coming from a more unitive perspective on life and consciousness. Just how do you see that balancing between the individual desires and initiative and personality with the merging or unity between you?
I'd say we're both pointed in the same direction, and we have our individual preferences and our individual differences, and those are really secondary, and they get taken care of, but it's all in the service of something that we're both focused on.
It seems organic.
Yeah, it's organic.
A way that I would say the same thing as about the balance, you know, we discover when we're getting out of balance. Obvious, and then we can just, you know, come back to balance, and whether that just means, you know, canceling something or whether it simply is an internal process is just determined by finding the balance, and it's actually quite exciting. That we can say we have choice in our lives, that we are so blessed that we can say yes or we can say no to each other and to the world, and it's fine. It all works out. I feel like our relationship has really matured, and that's part of what, when I can say it's organic, that's what I mean. That it does have a life of its own, and there are corrections that have to be made, but they're just obvious. When they're made, there are talks sometimes we have to have. I can't remember even when the last one was, but it just...
been years.
Yes.
As I'm hearing you both speak, it's beautiful to hear you dancing together. And there was one thing that you spoke to before that I wanted to pick up again, which was around your vows. You spoke about your original vow when you first got married of being this vow to freedom, and you know that was the most important thing, and if your relationship served that, you would continue, and if it didn't, then you would let it go. And Stephen and I were recently at a couples retreat where we spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, what are our shared values and what are the vows we want to recreate for this next phase of our relationship. And this was just a few weeks ago. So we rewrote our vows and made a new commitment to each other. And just wondering what your own vows were for the second time you got together. And is that something that is kind of a guiding post for your relationship at this point? Because it's pretty different, at least the vows Stephen and I wrote, than the vows people traditionally take when they get married, which aren't often coming from people's interior experience. They're more the just till death do us part. So wondering if the vows are important for you at this point, and if that helps you, or if it's really irrelevant.
We actually didn't do vows the second time.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so the nature of the commitment at this point, how do you define it then? Is it just...
It's self-evident.
Uh-huh.
It's self-evident.
Yes, but for me at that time, it was really important. And I think we got into this more as our marriage, our second time around marriage, began to unfold. And that was to tell the truth, which is really what that earlier exercise was about in an earlier phase of our relationship. But it was to tell the truth, not so much as a process, but as part of the integral aspect of the relationship, that we didn't take a formal vow, but in a way we came together in service to telling the truth. And in that, given that our lives are already surrendered to the spiritual truth, that actually included mundane truths and less than perfect truths, and, you know, like, I don't want to do this, or, you know, things that before we might have dismissed as, oh, that's just ego. We were actually willing to invite ego and to invite simple desires of the body or desires of the mind or emotions to be a part of our life. And this was really important. It integrated something at a deeper level that had been put aside for a higher purpose, but now was welcomed back. Even when you...
And I say it was there when we started, too, honey. You know, like, when we first got together, it was really about truth, telling the truth. And we did tell the truth. I'm sorry?
Yeah, it was a bigger truth, though. It was the big truth.
Yeah, it was the truth as deeply as you know, we knew it maybe, but and we just were babies. I was a baby anyway, you know. So I told the truth as deeply as I could, and yes, I could tell the truth on a cosmic level, but on an emotional level, I really didn't know the truth. I was so. That's really where I think we've come together on a different level of it now. That there's a deeper clarity, and so we're more transparent with each other, and that allows the truth to shine forth more easily, more effortlessly. So before, I'd say we were committed to truth, but it was stuff running that we weren't speaking because we didn't really, I didn't at least have a language for it, maybe. You know, I was still immature there, emotionally.
And in a certain way, it didn't matter. We were living our deeper truth. This is sort of paradoxical,
right.
But this was our experience. We were living our deeper truth. We both were very happy. I was fulfilled in the world. I didn't feel I needed anything. And so the little grittiness that was in this middle zone didn't seem that big of an issue until it did, and then it was huge. But there was a way it could be dismissed because of a very deep happiness and because of a superficial happiness. This miserable unhappiness was dismissed, and maybe it was just exposing that to each other in that year where we spent a lot of time speaking and sometimes crying and really taking responsibility for how we had betrayed each other in subtle and gross ways throughout the 30 years, that we really did flush something through our system as a couple, through the system of the couple. And so I understand the problem you're having even articulating it now. It's not like a process. It's what's alive in us. It is a commitment, of course.
Mm. Yeah, and what I'm just hearing for this is that there's very radically different approaches to having a conscious relationship, and what worked for the two of you, which was to go beyond, you know, any vows or other than really telling the truth, is perhaps different than what, you know, we found really helpful, useful, you know, recently in our own evolution of relationship. And so it's, there's no one mold is really what I'm taking from this.
Dave, I think that's really the most important thing. There's no particular formula. There may be styles that you are in affinity with, but there's no formula that you have to fit yourself into, any of us. If there were, we wouldn't be in relationship because we don't fit the formula.
We don't fit the mold. So we can forget the mold.
Dissolve the mold. It's beautiful. So one of the themes this week, we're looking to how do the relationship principles begin to extend into a wider orbit. And I know you guys have taught somewhat frequently together. And so moving from being in loving partnership to being in co-creative worldly partnership, just any particular lessons in that process or challenges that you had to surmount?
That's interesting. You know, we do. I love teaching with Eli, but we found that we also love teaching individually. And one of the things that happens when we teach together is that we both want to be the teacher.
Uh-huh.
Like, so it's an interesting surrender there to share.
And when it's surrendered, it flows like a jazz piece. You know, it's spontaneous and fresh and. We can finish each other's thoughts and finish each other's sentences, and I love it when it's flowing.
Thrilling, actually. That's really, really in a very intimate way, being with each other and with the group and inviting the group, and then the group is also a partner in that, and we don't know what the outcome will be. We're discovering it all together.
Well, why don't we go ahead and start opening for some questions. We have quite a few people on the live line and webcast. People can type questions, as some are already doing, in the webcast. And if you have a question on the live line, just touch 1, and we can take some of those. David, you want to grab one of the webcast ones?
Yeah, sure. Here's a question that's coming in from Anne. Anne says, would you share some of the things you each did individually in order to receive each other's more painful truths? I think she was talking about when you were talking about sharing what you loved and didn't love about each other, how you prepared for that.
Well, you know, Eli mentioned how his tendency would have been to be defensive, but we just laid out ground rules that there was no speaking to the other when they were sharing what they didn't like or what they loved about the other. And for me, it was sort of the opposite. My tendency would be to implode as I was hearing what was unlikable about me. I mean, I may want to defend and say, that's not true, but my tendency would be to take it in and turn towards self-hatred. And so there was the instructions that we gave each other for this process was to be really present with the other as they're saying that. So that allowed me to not follow my tendency of implosion and to really hear what my partner was saying that was negative and to feel it. And it was painful. It was very painful. But only doing it once, we knew that it was worth the pain, that the benefits were of clearing the field and ending with the expression of love.
Beautiful. Thank you. Let's see.
Great. So let's go to Carolyn. You're live.
Well, I have a follow-up sort of to that because I could just seeing this would be putting me on the road to divorce if we went through this exercise. I think we would just be both so hurt. So how do you go, what after you've done this exercise, yeah, you may end with a loving, you know, I like this about you sort of thing, but then how do you, you know, what has been said is probably very hurtful. So how do you adjust for that? How does that become part of your new relationship if the relationship continues?
Well, you have to assume that the person is not speaking out of malice. I know when Gangaji is letting me know what she doesn't like about me or what's going on, that she's not doing it to intentionally hurt me. This is her expression of her experience and her reality. And then I have to examine it within myself. What is it that's going on within me that's creating this in her, if there is? If there isn't, no problem. If there is, then I have to face it and deal with it. And that's then I get to then have the benefit of deepening from her feedback.
Mm-hmm. And what happens if you have a partner that sort of runs in the other direction with you're going to start talking about anything emotional?
Well, I'm not sure that this would work for everyone. I think it really depends on what you want from the exercise, and you have to come together in what you want. And Eli and I were doing this exercise when we had already come together and really wanting the relationship to somehow reflect the truth as the best we knew it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It really depends on what your relationship is based on. You know, this is something that most people, you know, don't examine. You know, it's like it starts out, our relationship usually is based on mutual attraction. But that mutual attraction doesn't last. I mean, the heat of the honeymoon somehow fades chemically over time. And then you're left with, well, what is it based on? Is it based on the children? Is it based on, if it's based on love, if it's based on truth, then it has the capacity to bear it. And so that really, you have to examine what is it? What is our relationship based in?
Thank you. Here's another question coming in. This one is from Elizabeth. Elizabeth is asking, how do I move on beyond a great love, one in which we were deeply connected and yet willing to end it so the other can have greater love? So how does one move on from a great love?
I don't know that you move on from love. I think you move on from forms of relationship. And it can be painful. It's a kind of death. But as you know, when people you love die, the love doesn't die. The essence of the relationship. And it's not my experience that true love dies. Although it is my experience, it's certainly relationships, forms of relationship die. And it can be excruciating because we are attached to particular forms. So it's...
But to try to move on from... I can say to try to move on from true love, then you're turning away from the love that's already alive in your heart. What Gandhi's saying is that love doesn't die, doesn't go anywhere.
And you,
and
can,
you can bear everything.
You can mourn the loss of the form of that love. And just as when you lose someone in death, you can grieve that. And if you're willing to fully grieve, you can discover that grief too is an aspect of love. And you can, and then that, over time, naturally, organically, fades to some degree anyway. But it's not something that's in your control. You aren't doing the moving on. The moving happens by itself in your willingness to lose what has been lost. Only form.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So be willing to just acknowledge the love and change the form and go through the emotionality and the pain that is part of that process to allow something new to emerge.
That's what we did, and what emerged was we got back together. It was really a surprise.
Yeah, it's a good sign you really did the process fully, too, then. So why don't we go to Beth, who's on the live line.
Hello?
Hi.
I'm on the air?
Yes.
Ah. Hi. Hi, Eli, this is Beth. We've spoken before.
Hi, Beth.
And I've spoken with Gandhi three times. My real question is how to be a six in love.
You can't be, because it assumes that you are a six.
She got it right away.
So there's no problem then.
That's right.
That was fair.
Well, okay, so I bring the sickness to the table again and yet again. And again and yet again, it doesn't work.
Sorry, you bring what to the table? I didn't hear you.
My sickness, my trap, who I think I am.
That's right. Yeah, well, that's right, it doesn't work. So, time to stop.
Very easy and very hard.
Yes, simple and can be quite hard, but always simple, really.
And the more willing you are, the easier it is. Really, it's all about willingness. And so what I've discovered is if someone isn't willing, they say it's impossible. If they're kind of willing, they say, well, then how do I do it? If they're really willing, they have an immediate experience. And if they're fully willing, they drop in even deeper. So really, it's the depth of your willingness reveals your own self. And the lack of willingness reveals the defenses against yourself.
Right. Oh, looks like we know Beth Nola has the mic. So let's go to Mukara.
Can I just say one thing
Sure.
about that? That was so beautiful, Eli, because really that's the point. When you are saying reveals the depth of yourself, then yourself is love. You are discovering yourself as love. And that's why you really can't move on from that. There are particular forms that may evoke that, but it's coming from yourself. It is in yourself, and it is limitlessly yourself.
And that's why you can't be a six and deal with love, because imagining yourself as a six, which is a ego fixation, is what's separate from love. And so in that, it's a contradiction in terms. You give up your false identity, be yourself, and then love is no problem for yourself.
Beautiful answer. Love it. So let's go to Mukara. You're live.
Are you there, Mukara?
Yes, I'm here. My question is, it's about your experience of freedom. If you could just speak a little bit about that, because you sound wonderfully bonded to each other, and yet you sound so free. And I think that's a fascinating paradox.
Yeah, isn't that
it
amazing?
It is a paradox.
It is. It's all such a mystery. But, you know, we are also bound by our bodies and in relationship by our bodies, and we can discover freedom in the midst of bondage. And when Eli was speaking about our earlier vows, he was really in a certain way saying that this bondage of form and form in relationship, be here to serve truth, be here to serve freedom. And it is possible, because freedom is bigger than any bondage, and any bonds.
And freedom is not conditional on anything outside. It doesn't require any particular, it doesn't have to look a certain way, it doesn't have to feel a certain way, it doesn't have to act a certain way. Freedom is prior. And so in being free and prior to time and form, prior to time and space, then what appears in time and space doesn't touch freedom. And then what appears in time and space is actually an expression of freedom. Freedom in the bondage of form, in the limitation of experiencing yourself as a somebody.
Right. I see a webcast question from Anastasia saying, is a relationship based on a commitment to raise children together enough to stay together?
Well, it's a beautiful commitment, you know. I don't know what happens when the children get raised. But if there's not love in that, and there must be at least the love of children to make a relationship based on that. I know that there are relationships who work very well, relationships that work very well that way. I don't have direct experience of that. I had a child in my first marriage, and it was not enough to keep the marriage together because it was somehow, I didn't understand at that time where freedom really was. If you are free, then you can be in relationship or not be in relationship. You can be in relationship for the children, or you can be in relationship for the companionship, because you are free. And you can end a relationship, you can start a relationship. But it, just as Eli said, it's the freedom that's first, because it is. It's always here.
Why don't we go to Deb? You have the mic. Deb, are you there? Okay, then let's go to a question from...
There's a whole bunch here that have come in on the webcast. Let's see, here's one that comes in from Kimmy. Kimmy is saying, when a person's actions do not match their words, how do I know whether to forgive the person not to repeat the same mistakes again, though they've broken trust, versus creating healthy boundaries? Which I imagine they're saying would mean potentially shifting the relationship.
Well, I don't know that you can know what the outcome is going to be of your action in relation to this other person, but you can discover, and life is a discovery, and you can discover what it is you want. And if what you want is to be back in relationship in some way, then there has to be trust, and there has to be a willingness to know that trust could be betrayed again, and that you can bear it, that you can deal with it, that your heart may break, but the heart only breaks more open and can bear anything. So, of course, it means being intelligent in terms of conversations and discussions and commitments, but finally, you can't know. It's out of your control.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, I don't know what you would say, Eli.
Yeah, I'd say that love is trustworthy. And it's really about, what's it based on? If it's based in love, then there can be a deeper exposure and a deepening into a bonding. And if it's based on anything else, that will be exposed, and the relationship won't be stable. Most relationships are deal-making.
Well, that kind of speaks to another question from the webcast from Jeannie, who asks, do you think it takes both people who want to be in a conscious relationship in order to have one? Or can you have a conscious relationship that with only one person's desire for it?
You know, what I've seen is that I've seen there's several times that people have come and their partner is not interested at all. And I've watched, in particular, a couple of people who have had deep awakening. And their partner is not interested in spirituality, not interested in awakening. And yet in awakening and in love, the love naturally spreads and the partner naturally receives it. And it can be very beautiful deepening, and they have their own process and their own way, and they may never call it spirituality, they may never call it awakening, and yet the love that is free-flowing naturally nourishes them, and they naturally benefit from it, and the relationship can happen that way.
Beautiful. Yep.
Go ahead, Deva.
I was going to say, Gangaji, if there's anything you want to add, and then maybe just one more question before we close.
Well, I love what Eli said, because to me that's the beauty of it, of freedom. Freedom doesn't require anybody to be in a particular way. And of course there are always challenges, even if it's a commitment to a conscious relationship on both parts. There are always challenges, and those challenges then are met, whether you're meeting them alone or you're meeting them with a partner, alone in a partnership or with a partner in a partnership, is finally irrelevant. If you are where you are, and in this moment you can discover the freedom, and then from that you see where it takes you. It takes you deeper in the relationship, or it takes you out of the relationship.
So beautiful. Well, I really appreciate both of you for the deep wisdom, and also just hearing you two together and the way that you dance together is also very instructive. I know that we are coming to the end of our time here and want to make sure that you both have a chance to speak anything that you have coming up, ways that people might find out about your work. And as they're speaking, if there's anyone who would like to be on their email list, if you would go ahead and press 2 now on your keypad as they're speaking, then we can also get them directly onto your email list.
Well, Eli's in Europe right now. I'm getting ready to join him. I'm leading a retreat in California at this moment. I'm on break between sessions, and I think the websites are always the best place. I'll be in Zurich and London, and then we'll be together in Germany, and Eli will be in Amsterdam. And you can find all of that out on Leela, L-E-E-L-A dot org, or Gangaji, GANGAJI.org. That's the easiest. You can see our schedule. We both have schedules in North America and Europe and Australia and New Zealand. And we have ongoing programs, online programs as well.
Great. Okay, so those of you who are listening to the recording or are on the audio cast, you'll need to go though to those sites on your own. And those of you that are on the Maestro call who have just pressed 2, or go ahead and press 2 now, we'll give them your email addresses so you can be directly in touch with each other. And then finally, maybe just to close out, we wanted to know, based on your experience as kind of closing words, if there's one piece of practical wisdom you'd each like to share with our participants in closing.
Mm-hmm. Love is trustworthy. That may seem abstract, and it may seem like it's some kind of concept or belief, but it's actually factually true. It's not. It's specific. It's direct. It applies to every situation. It applies to every life circumstance. It applies to every moment. That actually, love is trustworthy, and if you're willing to turn towards love, everything from the most mundane to the most spectacular is revealed and resolved. That would be the practical advice that I would give.
Beautiful. Very poetic as well.
Oh, yeah. I would just add one thing, and that's that it's also not controllable. And we are so used to controlling things in our minds, and we are slain by love. And to be willing to recognize that it is a force bigger than our minds, that force also welcomes aspects of our minds, but it cannot be controlled. We love when we love.
Well, as always, I just wanted to say it's such a blessing. Your words, both of you, just come from such a deep source of being and an open, loving acceptance of what is, that creates a tremendous acceptance for me and for others to just relax into all of who we are. And I think that creates a really whole different kind of feeling tone for creating a spiritual partnership. So really appreciate your vulnerability and sharing your own journey and some of the challenge points today, as well as just that deep, loving, open, accepting heart you've shared with us.
Beautiful to be with the two of you. It's wonderful to meet you, Deva, and feel you on this call. Always, Stephen.
Thank you both.
Thank you for making time in your busy schedules from Berlin and workshops to join us for this hour.
So grateful to be here. Thank you so much.